Well, I was really honored when the organizers asked me to speak first, until I realized that most of them were my collaborators. Anyway.
Yeah. Also asked me to speak last.
Well, that's a different kind of honor, yeah. It's an extra 20 minutes to talk, right? So, anyway, the hierarchy is the enormous ratio of the weak to Planck scales. But is this okay? Should we turn on some lights? No? And it's really interesting to note that we only have a small number of tricks, of mechanisms for producing really large ratios of mass scales, and we use them over and over again. Not only do we as theorists use them over and over again, but nature uses them over and over again. For example, in the standard model, dimensional transmutation or normalization group flow, in the standard model determines the scale of the strong interaction, and throughout condensed matter physics, it's a source of large ratios of scales. The classic examples are superconductivity, BCS superconductivity, and the Kondo effect, both of which can be thought of as a normalization group flow with a coupling getting strong. So given such a small number of ideas for such a fundamental problem, it's really striking to have a brand new one. But in fact, that's what happened a couple of years ago. Randall and Sundrum found a new and very stringy mechanism for producing large hierarchies. Their idea is based on warped compactification. Compactification where the scale of the four-dimensional metric depends on where you are in the compact dimensions. Now, on the face of it, this is not such a big deal. The warp factor here doesn't break any of the symmetries of the unwarped theory. That is, you still have the SO31 Lorentz invariants. And in fact, warp compactations have been thought of over the years, but mostly the warping was regarded as an annoying complication. And I think it's only recently that it's been realized that it has really potentially important physical effects. Namely, suppose this warp factor goes to zero somewhere in the compact space. That means that there is an arbitrarily large gravitational redshift as you approach that point. So if you have a clock in the compact dimensions, then this clock speed depends on where you are, and by moving it closer and closer and closer to the point of vanishing warp factor, you can make the clock run as slow as you want. Saying that in terms of energy rather than time, the symmetries, the killing vectors in this metric are just translations of the x mu. So what we mean by energy, the thing which is conserved, is just d by dx zero. However, because of the warp factor, so this is sort of the energy as would be seen by a four-dimensional observer, the thing which is conserved. But there's another notion of energy, which would be the energy as measured in a local 10-dimensional inertial frame. And these differ because of the non-trivial metric. And in particular, because this warp factor can go to zero, they can differ by a lot. And I must have gotten that upside down, of course, because Yes, I did. That's should have brought a pen. That's delta upstairs. Anyway, the point is that starting from a single invariant energy scale, starting from a single 10-dimensional energy scale, one can generate a large number of very different four-dimensional energy scales, just depending on where physics is located in the compact space. Turning that around also, what seems to be, from our point of view, a relatively low energy like a TeV can be, from the point of view of an inertial observer, an enormous energy, a stringy energy, and so this can produce string scale physics quantum gravity at a TeV. Okay, so this is, again, having this new and strikingly different way of generating large ratios of mass scales is certainly interesting and deserves to be explored. Now, this, in principle, Kaluza and Klein could have thought of this. The reason, well, but in fact, the reason that it's a more recent idea is that really to both to produce this warp factor, this large warp factor, and to take advantage of it, that is to localize physics in the compact space, you need brains. And the significance of brains is a relatively recent idea. And it's because, of course, of brains that this idea is a natural outgrowth of string theory. Again, brains both produce the large warp factor and produce a means of localizing physics in the compact space. And so what I want to do today is to go some distance towards constructing a detailed stringy model of the Randall-Sundrum type. And now I'm not going to try to do everything. I'm not going to worry about where the standard model fields come from. My main goal is to, in fact, try to get a large hierarchy, try to get an exponentially large ratio of mass scales from pure numbers. And in the end, that I will do, there will be some e to the something, and something is calculable and pure numbers, and it's big. Nevertheless, I have to say, this is not going to be totally successful. In particular, there is some question of the ratios of different mass scales and also the fixing of the moduli not being entirely satisfactory. So it's not something which is in sufficiently finished form that it could be immediately applied to phenomenology or cosmology. Anyway, the main issue I said, in the original Randall-Sundrum model, there was nothing to fix the question, nothing to fix how close the weak brain or whatever the brain is that sits that feels the large redshift, how close the weak brain sits to the horizon. The Randall-Sundrum model, the original Randall-Sundrum model, allows an arbitrarily large hierarchy, but it doesn't tell you what the value of that hierarchy is. It's a modulus that can take any value. And so again, my goal is to do a calculation that gives me a number, and the number is the size of the hierarchy. In the context of sort of model building, this is what Goldberger and Wise did. They added a scalar field to the Randall-Sundrum model and found with appropriate couplings that it produced a definite large value for the hierarchy. So what you can say is that what I'm trying to do is a stringy realization of Randall and Sundrum. The outline for my talk first, some global issues, in particular a no-go theorem, which is not really a no-go theorem, but it's actually a useful way to see how to go about building such a model. Then the local physics near the region of large warp factor, which will be a geometry first described by Klebanoff and Strassler. And then finally, calculation of the hierarchy. I should say that what I'm going to describe to a large extent is extending work of Verlinde and collaborators. There have been various other papers, this probably is far from complete, about getting large warp factors out of string theory. Anyway, but this, as you'll see as we go along, is an extension of things that Hermann has done. So first, the global question and the no-go theorem. I'm going to talk about 2B string theory because 2B has three brains. And so here's a general warped metric, which I've reparameterized a little bit for convenience, but it's a general warped metric. And similarly, a general 2B background with the given symmetries, so a 5-form field strength with a potential alpha, a 3-form field strength with Ramond and Nevaux-Schwartz parts, and a dilaton, and a Ramond, scalar. And Einstein's equation, the non-compact parts of Einstein's equation, actually give you a lot of information. They tell you that, you can package it this way. The Laplacian, the tilde here is the unwarped metric. The Laplacian of some power of the warp factor is a sum of terms, the 3-form flux squared, the 5-form flux squared, and the gradient of the warp factor squared. And the thing to notice is that everything on the right-hand side is positive, but the left-hand side, well, in a compact space, would integrate to zero. And in fact, if you want to get at the end of the day a finite Newton's constant and not unacceptable singularities, you probably need such compactness. So if on a compact space, the left-hand side integrates to zero, and therefore every term on the right-hand side has to vanish. And that's pretty discouraging because it tells you that there's no three-form flux, there's no five-form flux, there's no warp factor, and you're done. Okay, this is actually an old result from the 80s, and Maldacena and Nunez have reapplied it in the context of you know, recent ideas. Now, it's very, very nice because it tells you what you can't do. It tells you that you can't just think about supergravity. You're not going to produce an interesting compactification just using supergravity. But of course, we don't have just supergravity. We have string theory as well. And there can't be a no-go theorem because Hermann has provided us with an example. He points out that just take the familiar 2B string theory on T6 mod Z2, the orientifold, which is T-dual to type 1 on T6. And that's got 16 D3 brains and O3 planes in the corners. And he points out that if you just bring the D3 brains together, 16 is a reasonably large number, and so there should be some modest range of couplings, not too big, not too small, where in fact it's a good approximation to think about this region here not as D3 brains, but as an ADS geometry, a warp geometry. Okay, and so there's the example. And the reason that it evades Einstein's equation is that it does have not just supergravity fields, but localized sources. And in particular, the orientifold planes have a negative tension. By the way, I've talked about the integrated Einstein's equations, but also the integrated Bianchi identity for the five-form field strength. The fact that these things have flux lines coming out of them provides a similar constraint, which is also nicely satisfied by this configuration. Both positive tension and positive charge, negative tension, negative charge. Okay. So more generally, then in addition to the supergravity fields, one has additional localized things, brains, which make a contribution to the right-hand side of that field equation. And in order to get something interesting, you need something negative on the right-hand side. What appears actually is not the tension, but the effective tension, which depends also on the dimension of the object. So you'll notice that 7 brains make no contribution. 8 brains and 9 brains would make a negative contribution, but they're kind of complicated. The other way to get a negative contribution is to have like a three-dimensional thing, but whose tension is negative. And again, O3 planes do that. Also, D7 brains do that if they're appropriately wrapped on 4 cycles so that the induced D3 brain charge is negative. The 7 brain part makes no contribution to that field equation, but the induced negative 3 brain charge comes with an induced negative tension and makes a negative contribution. So the idea then is that one needs some kind of stringy negative tension object, and then the no-go theorem loses its force, and one can have a warped solution. Now, the no-go theorem, besides telling us that we need these objects, is also useful because it actually can be pushed a little further to give the complete form of the solution. In particular, the objects I've been talking about, the O3 brains and the wrapped D7 brains, have the nice property that their tension, although it can go negative, can't be any more negative than their D3 brain charge. So all of these objects satisfy a BPS-like condition. All of these objects satisfy a BPS-like condition that their tension is not too negative. Again, their negative tension comes only from their negative D3 brain charge. And by combining the field equation I was talking about with the Bianchi identity, you get a very nice sum of squares, which tells you the complete form of the solution. The warp factor is related to the five-form potential. This is a relation which goes all the way back to the black three-brain solutions. The three-form flux has to be imaginary self-dual in the compact space, meaning that it's either 2, 1 holomorphic anti-homomorphic indices or 0, 3. And in fact, this set of so in fact, this has brought us back to a set of solutions which were first described in M theory by the Beckers and then have been translated into a dual 2B form by a variety of people. So this particular special set of negative tension objects that brings us back to things that are more or less already known. I should mention that there are other kinds of things in string theory which don't satisfy this inequality. For example, anti-orientifold three planes have a negative tension and a positive induced charge, so they don't satisfy that. Orientifold five planes or anti-five planes have a negative tension and a zero induced charge. So in fact, the set of solutions I'm talking about is a small subset of the full set of 2B solutions that with warping. And it certainly would be interesting and much harder to explore sort of more of the rest of the space. But this special set has a bunch of interesting properties. Now, in the first place, the three-form flux has to be imaginary self-dual, but supersymmetry is in general broken. It's broken unless the 0-3 part, the I bar, J bar, K part, vanishes. Nevertheless, the cosmological constant is zero. And I'm going to come back to this later on. But it's interesting that one has a set of solutions where supersymmetry is broken, but the cosmological constant is zero. What's happening in detail here is the following. This relation, the self-duality of the three-form flux, basically means that in terms of it acting as a gravitational source and a Ramond-Ramond source, the three-form flux acts like a smear distribution of D3 brains. So as with D3 brains, there's a no-force condition. There's no potential associated with this flux. And so even though, so that this flux produces no net four-dimensional energy, and in fact, the different components of the flux each leave some supersymmetry unbroken, but all the components taken together leave no supersymmetry unbroken. But in such a way that they don't conspire to produce any vacuum energy. Oh, and by the way, one bad thing. There's always going to be a radial modulus because this condition in particular, which is the one really necessary condition, is invariant under rescaling the compact space. And so these as with those of you who were around in the early 80s and remember no-scale models, remember that they have these three defining properties. There's always a volume modulus. There is zero cosmological constant to at least first approximation, really only first approximation. And supersymmetry is broken. And the scale of supersymmetry breaking, by the way, depends on the volume modulus. It's undetermined. That's, in fact, why they were called no-scale models. OK, so that's the global structure of the solutions. It's got these various negative tension sources. And it's the actual detailed form of the solution is in this special class that people have been talking about. So that's how you get a warped compactification. The next question is how you get a large warp factor, because we don't just want any old warping. We want warping which becomes very, very large. And here, Hermann has basically, we're going to start with Hermann and move on. But he's shown us what to do. Just take a bunch of D3 brains on a Calabi-Yau space and put them together. And we know from ADS-CFT that the local geometry near a bunch of D3 brains is ADS-5 cross S-5, which, of course, in the Poincaré coordinates, is indeed a warped space with a warp factor that becomes arbitrarily small. Now, this is good, but it's not good enough for what I want to do, because, again, this allows an arbitrarily large hierarchy, but it doesn't determine how big the hierarchy is. If I put another D3 brain in this background, a probe brain or a weak brain, there is no potential for that brain. It can sit anywhere. It can sit arbitrarily close to the horizon. And so the value of the hierarchy is still undetermined. Now, this is related at least in part to the fact that there's an effective n equals 4 supersymmetry in the low energy physics. D3 brains in a flat space have n equals 4 supersymmetry. D3 brains on a Calabi-Yau manifold have to first approximation, to the extent that you ignore the curvature of the manifold, have n equals 4 supersymmetry. And it's interesting to think about how that gets broken by the curvature of the manifold. But it seems that it doesn't produce a potential, again, for a weak brain or a pro-brain. I can say that first at the level of the classical supergravity approximation I'm talking about here, because one just knows that there, classically there are solutions with D3 brains located anywhere. Also, you might, from the point of view of effective field theory, imagine that some kind of superpotential could be generated in the low energy theory of a brain near the other brains. Now, on a Calabi-Yau manifold where there's no freeform flux, there is no such, the symmetries prevent such a superpotential, but it seems that more generally, even when we turn on three-form fluxes, it's impossible to get in the class of models I'm talking about, a potential for a pro-brain, and so there's nothing again here that will fix the size of the hierarchy. So essentially what we want to do is we want to take this idea, but we want to break the supersymmetry from n equals 4 down to n equals 1. And the nice thing is that because this same local, so now that we're talking about the local geometry on the near the region of large warp factor, the problem is really isomorphic to ADS-CFT duality. We're not seeing the whole outside, the whole Calabi-Yau, just the local ADS-5 cross S5 geometry. And so the problem is simply the problem of finding ADS-CFT duals or gauge gravity duals with less supersymmetry. And that, of course, is something lots of people have thought about, in particular, Klebanoff and a series of collaborators. We can simply take their work and carry it over. So Verlinde puts the D3 brains at a smooth point of a Calabi-Yau. The next most complicated thing to do is to take a Calabi-Yau with a generic singularity, a conifold singularity, and to put the D3 brains there. And that does indeed break the supersymmetry to n equals 1. So here's what that local region looks like. The conifold is a cone, but the base, instead of being a 5-sphere, is topologically a product of a 2-sphere and a 3-sphere, which I've tried to draw like that. And the D brains, again, are sitting down at the apex of the cone. Now, the warped geometry is still an ADS space. It's still ADS-5, but it's now crossed this base. Now, this still isn't good enough. Although the supersymmetry has been broken to n equals 1, this is still a conformal theory. You can see that because there's an ADS-5 factor in the geometry. And what that means is there's still a scaling symmetry. There is still nothing. I can still put a D3 brain anywhere on this space. And so there is still, again, an arbitrary value for the hierarchy. There's still no dynamics that would fix it at some given distance and thereby produce a given large radius. So again, I said Klebanoff and a series of collaborators. This is Klebanoff and Witten. Klebanoff and Gubser showed how to add one more ingredient and break the conformal invariance, namely D5 brains, which are wrapped on the 2-sphere and extended in the 3 directions. Now, they collapse, of course. Tension wants that to fall into the bottom of the cone. So what you really have is D3 brains and wrapped D5 brains sitting at the base of the cone. And all these things produce flux. And to remind you of that, since they can't see the D5 brains anymore, I've drawn here the Ramon flux, which is on the 3-sphere, the dual 3-sphere, which is produced by the D5 brain. Now, this, of course, conifolds are singular, but they're good singularities. We know that string theory makes sense on such a space. This is now a bad singularity. The flux gravitates, and down here at the bottom of the cone, where it all squinches together, gravitates a lot, and it produces a bad singularity. This is the Klebanoff and Saitlin solution. But finally, as Klebanoff and Strassler showed, this picture deforms to this picture, which is supposed to be a deformed conifold. It's not a conifold anymore because it's not a cone. As you go to the base, the 3-sphere stops getting smaller. This is actually a smooth manifold. And also the brains are gone, because the point where they were wrapped has disappeared. They're gone but not forgotten, because they're replaced with flux. There was the Ramon flux, which was originally sourced by the D5 brains and is now sourceless. It simply lives in the space. But also, on the dual cycle, there's a Nouveau-Schwartz flux. And the reason that that dual flux has to be there is that we had D3 brain charge, and the D3 brains are gone, and D3 brain charge can also be carried by crossed Ramon and Nouveau-Schwartz fluxes, and that's what's happening there. Okay, so finally, this is the local geometry. This is the local geometry for the solution I'm talking about. Again, I could have said, rather than starting with brains, I could have said we need a special point where the warp factor gets large. Well, one kind of special point is a singularity. The generic singularity is a conifold. So I could have forgotten about brains, said let's just have a conifold singularity. And I could have said I know that by turning on appropriate fluxes, I can stabilize this at some given radius. And I could have just asserted that. But the reason I knew that was, the reason we knew that was because we followed this series of steps. Now, yes. In the terminology of Randall syndromology, this is Randall syndrome 2, meaning that the warp factor becomes arbitrarily large as you approach the bottom of the cone. And this is Randall syndrome 1. It's no longer singular. The bottom of the cone has been rounded a little bit. And so the warp factor gets smaller as you move down the cone, and at some point stops getting smaller. So it's got some small but non-zero minimum value, which is the distinguishing feature of Randall syndrome 1. Okay, so the summary of parts 1 and 2 is that in order to do this, one starts with a Klobuchar space, or an F-theory compactification, and either take an O3-fold, meaning that has fixed points, or in the F-theory case, it could still be an orientifold. It could be an O7-fold, meaning it has fixed four planes. But take either of these. Again, that produces the negative tension objects. Let the Calabi-Yau sit near a conifold singularity, turn on appropriate fluxes. So that's something which is pretty generic, not so complicated. And find at the end of the day that there is a large warp factor, which I will now calculate. So just to keep things simple, I'm going to keep only three generic moduli, the dilaton and its Ramon partner, the Calabi-Yau volume and its Ramon partner, and the modulus for the deformation of the conifold. So z equals zero is the singular conifold, and finite z means the conifold has been blown up. The dynamics is governed by a superpotential, which has a simple form. Its simple natural form just is the integral of the Calabi-Yau three-form wedged into the three-form flux, integrated over the six-dimensional compact space. And there's a Kähler potential whose form isn't going to matter too much, except that its dependence on the radial modulus, the volume, has a distinctive form. This is just what you get from dimensional reduction. And also, you know, it has to be of this form because I've already said there's a radial modulus, and this is the so-called no-scale Kähler potential, which produces a radial modulus. The potential is then a supergravity-looking thing, except that in supergravity, there's a negative term. And in this case, the negative term is precisely canceled by the positive terms from rho, leaving just positive terms from all the other fields. And so in particular, there's a static zero cosmological constant solution provided the derivatives of the superpotential with respect to the Z modulus and the tau modulus vanish. This is two complex equations for two moduli, and so it generically has solutions. And again, these are solutions where the cosmological constant is zero, but where the radial modulus is undetermined. Now, good. So this is the superpotential. The fluxes are m units of Ramon flux on the collapsing 3-cycle. That again was produced by those D5 brains that were wrapped. And then k, or maybe minus k, units of Navot-Schwarz flux on the dual cycle. If you look at the Klebanov-Strasser solution, you see that the Ramon flux and the Navot-Schwarz flux are sort of perpendicular. And again, because the fluxes are replacing the original D3 brains, the induced D3 brain charge is the product of M and K, which is the original D3 brain charge. And also, in order to stabilize the moduli nicely and also to be generic, one needs also some other flux on some unrelated cycle. And now the superpotential here just comes out in terms of the flux quanta times the periods of the Calabi-Yau manifold. And also the dilaton appears because it was hidden back in the definition of G. And these functions, curly G of Z and Z prime of Z, are things which are calculable, hypergeometric functions and things like that, just in terms of the complex geometry of the Calabi-Yau. The thing which is distinctive, the thing which is important, is that that the period the period associated with the collapsing 3-cycle, well, okay, there's one which is Z, and the dual one has a logarithm in Z. And again, this is a property of conifolds. It's a distinctive property of the conifolds. So this is the superpotential, and it has a log of Z in it, and that's going to be important. I should mention, by the way, that this superpotential was first written down in this context by Kumran a few months ago, but I think, and I should check this, that this superpotential is actually the one which was written down by Viniziano and collaborators something like 18 years ago as an effective theory of N equals 1 QCD. But anyway, this is the superpotential. And as I said, you look for the stationary points, the potential. And indeed, you find that the two equations fix the two moduli. The dilaton is fixed. And it's fixed in terms of, well, first of all, these things, which again are just functions depending on the geometry, but it's fixed also in terms of the flux quanta in a way which is adjustable. By changing the values of the flux quanta on different cycles, you can, within limits, make the dilaton not too large. Also, as promised, there's an exponentially small number in the problem. These are things of order 1. These are integers which are under control and could be 1 or 8 or whatever they need to be. And so the one gets an exponentially large or exponentially small scale coming out of pure numbers, and the pure numbers are the amounts of flux on different cycles. Now, neither of these should be surprising. The fact that the dilaton is fixed classically, of course, that doesn't happen in the heterotic string, because in the heterotic string, the dilaton couples in a universal way. But in the type 2 string, the dilaton couples differently to Ramon and Navot-Schwarz fluxes. And so once you have Ramon and Navot-Schwarz fluxes, you have a non-trivial dilaton potential. And so many people have commented on this. It's not surprising at all that the dilaton gets fixed. It's also not surprising that this particular geometry produces a large hierarchy, because there is a nice dual description. So if you actually ask what is the smallest value the warp factor takes, the minimum warp factor, which again is no longer zero but is something very small, it depends on the fluxes and the string coupling in this way. Now, what's the dual description? Okay, so the geometry near this point, again, is just the Klebanov-Strasser geometry. The low energy physics in this space is just the physics Klebanoff and Strasser described, meaning that it is dual to an n equals one gauge theory, a gauge theory with two gauge groups and bifundamentals, and a cascading renormalization group flow, which they described. And in particular, in this context, the flow would have k cascades. So this again, there's this seesaw where one coupling gets strong and the other weak, and then blah, blah, blah. And in this geometry, that happens k times. Each cascade eats up sort of one unit of one of the fluxes. And the renormalization group tells you that each cascade consumes this much ratio of scale. And so, in fact, the same exponential that one gets from the story I was telling you is obtained also in this dual picture just from renormalization group flow. So in fact, on my first transparency, I guess I was lying when I said that this was a new mechanism for generating large ratios of scales, because it is secretly dual to dimensional transmutation, even though it sounds totally, totally different. Well, I'm rather amazed that I'm about 10 minutes ahead of schedule. I usually take an hour to go through that many transparencies. So let me just summarize the features. What are the good and bad features? Well, the first good feature is, again, one has an exponentially large number hierarchy of scales from pure numbers. The dilaton is fixed, which again is a nice thing, but not a surprise. And supersymmetry is broken with zero cosmological constant, which certainly sounds wonderful. The bad news is, first of all, there is a modulus. The compactification scale is undetermined, and so that's unacceptable. The modulus gives you unacceptable long-range forces. Also, the supersymmetry breaking here is set by the compactification scale. Of course, one hoped that when one produced an exponentially small scale like this, that scale would in turn produce the supersymmetry breaking, which would lead to everything else. That's not what happens here. The supersymmetry is already broken up in 10 dimensions by the fluxes. And so it's fixed, it's fixed in terms of the compactification scale and not related to the small exponential. Now, that may not be a terrible thing. In a theory with large compact dimensions. In fact, although the Susi breaking scale is set by the compactification scale, it is not equal to it. They go to zero together, but the Susi breaking scale goes to zero faster. It goes to zero as the cube of the compactification scale. So this still may be an interesting thing. But of course, the big thing, and I'll come back to this again, is that this is all unstable to quantum corrections. Now, So this is the end of the first part of my talk. And since I have a little bit of time, I'll tell you something more we're trying to do. It's interesting to, again, I mentioned that these are not the most general models. These are, we considered a special subset of models with a special set of negative tension objects. It's interesting to just ask sort of generically, if we consider the most general model of this sort. So the ingredients are the supergravity fields and the various kinds of extended objects one has in string theory. Can one, with just and just classical physics, can one, with those ingredients, find models with all the moduli fixed? And one reason that this is an interesting question is that in a heterotic string, of course, the answer is no, because the dilaton's always sitting there. But now, since the dilaton gets fixed, things seem better than they were, and so maybe one can. Since I've got a little time, I'm going to draw transparency in real time. Can one find just any kind of classical string vacuum with all the moduli fixed? And the answer we think is that you can find, and also where things are under control, where you have actually small parameters, large radius, and small coupling, so you can trust the calculation. And again, we think that it's possible to get ADS vacua of this type, but not De Sitter or Minkowski vacua. So it's a very crude thing we're doing. We're just, again, turning on different fluxes, adding different brains to the problem, and we're asking how the different terms in the energy scale with the radius and the dilaton and the different moduli. And the basic thing is that to get an ADS vacuum, you just need two terms. You need one that goes negative. Let's just the horizontal direction here is the radius. You need one which gets negative at large radius, and you need one which gets positive at small radius. And of course, somewhere in the middle, there'll be a minimum. But to get something which has a positive or zero cosmological constant, you need something which gets positive at large radius, something which gets negative for a while, and then something which gets positive at really small radius. You need more terms. And this is for one modulus. And for every additional modulus, like the dilaton or some ratio of radii, you need at least one additional term in the potential. Anyway, it's not a very deep result. We just look at the terms, look at how they behave in different limits, and it seems as though one has examples where this can happen, but there aren't enough terms to make this happen. And I don't know what the significance is. Of course, again, this is entirely classical. So no Casimir energies, no instantons, just brain tensions and classical supergravity energy. Okay. So the organizers asked that we provide some vision for the future. And I always hate doing this. I sort of respond to local gradients of things, not global. And I had really hoped that I would use up my time. But I seem to have failed. Unless there are questions. But I tried. So I closed my eyes and I tried to visualize the future. But everywhere I looked, there was this Greek letter in front of my eyes, and I couldn't see anything. So I'm not going to give you any deep visions, but I will share with you a few random thoughts about the cosmological constant problem. I'm actually on record as saying it could be that the observed small value of the cosmological constant is some kind of cosmological and historic accident coming about from an underlying theory which has many, many, many vacua, and we happen, again, for historic reasons, to live in one with a very tiny cosmological constant. This, of course, is work with Raphael Busso, and it could be that this is the way nature works, especially since the cosmological constant is kind of zero, I mean non-zero seemingly, and non-zero with sort of an ugly anthropic value. One has to consider this possibility seriously. Actually, the models that Raphael and I were talking about are the same kind of things I've been talking about for the last 45 minutes, namely Calabi-Yau manifolds with various fluxes turned on. What we did in our work was to ignore the issue of stabilizing the Calabi-Yau. We just fixed its non-flux moduli, and so we were cheating, and as I just told you, that is cheating because it's actually very hard to find models in which all the moduli are stabilized. So I don't know whether string theory can really produce such a microphysics, but it certainly has a lot of states, and when you turn on fluxes, a lot of integers, and so it's in fact possible still that this is the way things work. But of course, I'd rather it weren't. Most of us, except for Raphael perhaps, would rather that it weren't this way. I'm sorry, Raphael, where are you? it would be nicer if it were something which were not so grubby and historic. If we wanted to go into historic science, we'd be doing something else. anyway, of course, the Randall-Sundrum idea was at first, very, very striking because it was really seemingly something which didn't fit into our normal four-dimensional effect of Lagrangians. And maybe it still is. There certainly have been a number of suggestions for why in the Rendle-Sundrum framework with truly non-compact internal dimensions, the cosmological constant would be zero. None of these seem persuasive, but it certainly is worth thinking about. Certainly in everything that I've told you, the Rendle-Sundrum models end up looking at the end of the day very prosaic. They not only give you back four-dimensional effect of Lagrangians, but they give you back four-dimensional effect of Lagrangians that were written down 15 years ago. So, okay. What about these no-scale models? Actually, one of the good things about being older than most of the people in the room is that I can recycle old stuff and you don't remember it, so you think it's visionary. It certainly, again, is striking that these theories have a, at some order of approximation, vanishing cosmological constant, even though supersymmetry is broken. But you have to remember how hard it is to really make this work, because you need that the quantum corrections, thank you, remove the radial dilaton. They lift that flat direction for the radial modulus, but they still preserve the property that the cosmological constant at the minimum is zero, and that seems like magic. Now, maybe there is some way that magic happens. Classically, the potential is a sum of squares, which doesn't usually happen in supergravity. Maybe the whole Hamiltonian is a sum of squares. Now, these squares, this looks like supersymmetry, but these squares can't be the supersymmetry generators because they don't exist. Supersymmetry is broken, and when a local symmetry is broken, there is no Q. Q is zero. So maybe there's some other things which are not the supersymmetry generators, but such that the Hamiltonian is a sum of squares. That would provide a natural reason why the cosmological constant would vanish, or if not vanish, maybe, you know, also be something small and positive. This comes to mind because actually, just recently, Svetich and various collaborators have looked at some solutions which have similar properties to the no-scale models, and they pointed out a property of pseudo-supersymmetry, where there is some kind of fermionic transformation, some kind of fermionic operator which leaves the background invariant. So maybe this can be made to work. Now, I don't know if this can be done in no-scale models. One thing one can do is one can test it by looking at the radiative corrections. And in particular, if this is true, the radiative corrections have to lift the energy. They have to be positive. Now, the radiative corrections include obvious things like, so in the no-scale models, the graviton remains massless, but the gravitino is massive because supersymmetry is broken. So already this, although the classical energy is zero, there is this obvious one-loop contribution to the energy. So you can calculate this, as with most Feynman graphs, it diverges. And so unfortunately the answer, so by the way, M3 halves here, the gravitino mass is undetermined. It depends on the radius of the compact space. So think of this as a potential for the field M3 halves. And the largest piece of this comes from the highest energy physics and is undetermined. No, there is no real wisdom about the size or sign of this term. I just want to mention that now that we have these sort of classical examples of no-scale models, where there's not Gluino condensation happening, but just classical field theory, it might be worth revisiting this and seeing whether in string theory there are any universal things one can say about, any surprising things about the quadratic term there. Okay, this is big because lambda here is the ultraviolet cutoff, the string scale, or the Planck scale. And then there's this other term which depends only on the light physics. It's the Coleman-Weinberg term. It depends only on the light spectrum. It can be positive or negative. The gravitino loop makes a positive contribution. Other loops can make a positive or a negative one. So it's kind of messy and undecided. So at the end of the day, just to remind you how hard this problem is, because no matter how clever you are, the world has an electron, and it doesn't have a generous selectron. And so we know that there is some contribution to the vacuum energy. There is some contribution to the vacuum energy, which is of order m electron to the fourth, which is way too big, and has to be canceled by some very, very clever mechanism that seems much more clever than anything that comes out of supersymmetry so far. There are various proposals, technigravity and the holographic principle, which would modify the value of this loop in some way. I just wanted to remind you how hard it is to do that, because we know this is just a low energy effective field theory graph. We know a lot about effective field theory. And particularly we know that if that loop is occurring in the presence not of the vacuum, but there happens to be a hydrogen atom nearby, then it does give a non-zero value. And the non-zero value is just the value which low energy field theory predicts, because this is just the Lamb shift. So it's very hard, both experimentally and theoretically, to modify field theory in such a way as to get rid of that number. Instead, you need something clever or ugly to cancel it. Thank you.
We started early, so there's lots of time for questions.
So if the cosmological
concept was zero in terms of an historical accident, wouldn't you expect that historical accident would affect other non-quantum fracture particles? Yeah, which doesn't sound like much fun. Yes. Again, we're not here because we wanted to be in a historical science. Yeah? Like the Higgs mass, for any of them, any and all of them. I mean, in particular, if it really means you've got to search through 10 to the 200th vacua for the one which happens to be close to zero, then you really have a difficult task. Yes. Yeah. Many of them should be in that span, and it's kind of the physics is a chaotic function of the energy. So there are many different kinds of physics in that narrow band, indeed.
Yeah. I know of examples in quantum constraint theory where you can, the racetrack problem is what I'm thinking of, where you can try to stabilize the electron in a small value of like using enough fluxes to
yes.
run the theta function.
Right.
And in those cases, in many examples, it's been shown that the N comes into the radiative corrections in other ways, in such a way that the problem is not obviously
under control. And I was wondering whether you have some feelings about the analogous problem. It's clear that when you get a small Dillard problem, because it's a ratio and something like that, that's the only source. Yes, yeah. Good. This is a really important point, and Tom is right. So the large number in this talk was 16, or in it was the number of D3 brains, which in Hermann's example was 16. In an F-theory compactification, maybe it's 822, but again, how big is that? So, in fact, none of these vacua are vacua in which the fluxes can be taken to be parametrically large and you can do an honest 1 over N expansion. These pictures only make sense, and actually, look, these pictures only make sense, to the extent that some number like 10 or 100 is a large number. Now, you can worry about the fact that that same large number is going to come into many, many different places. And the other thing I can say is that when you bring all of the flux together at one point on the Calabi-Yau manifold, then sort of locally, the large number appears only in sort of this one way. There's 100 handles in other parts of the manifold which decouple from the local physics. So, you know, there's some sense in which the local description that I've given is a valid one. But it's true, we probably do not live in a vacuum in which there is a continuously variable small parameter, or even a discretely variable small parameter that you can use as a basis for approximation.
So I'm going to write down your potentials on the real-time
time
therapy.
Yes.
Why do you insist that the potential should go from zero or large?
Good, that's a very good question. Good, thanks for catching that. I drew them. So the reason is that naively, consider, for example, a bulk cosmological constant that grows with the volume of the compact space. But then the four-dimensional Planck scale also grows with the volume. You've got to make a Weyl transformation to refer everything to four-dimensional energies. And that makes everything have that property that at large radius it falls. Even a bulk cosmological constant, which you think is an energy that grows with volume, actually shrinks with volume, because of the Weyl transformation that takes you to the Einstein frame in four dimensions. Right, that's a very good point, because that makes the problem harder. If you had energies which grew in both directions, it would be much easier to get a De Sitter or a zero cosmological constant minimum.
Okay.
Well, in these warped compactifications, the fluxes are really an alpha prime effect, meaning that they go as sort of alpha prime over R cubed, whereas the Kaluza-Klein energies go as 1 over R. So symmetries which are masses which are produced by the fluxes, and that includes gravitino mass, are smaller than the Kaluza-Klein masses. So it's nice because it does mean, although, that there is some kind of effective four-dimensional picture in it, and that might in fact be useful. I don't know if it was common. The answer I just gave you is specific to these examples of no-scale models. I'm not sure how it works in the heterotic string, because it always goes as rho, that modulus to the 3/2, but how that is related to the underlying volume varies. Anyway, that's the reason that in these models where you break some of the symmetries by turning on fluxes at large radius, you actually get a modest hierarchy. Yeah.
The bipartite quantum corrections fix the radial models, the one that you couldn't fix.
The answer is yes, unless they vanish for magical reasons. But they fix it, unfortunately, at zero or infinity. And that is because, supersymmetry allows a quadratically divergent energy proportional to the square of the supersymmetry breaking. So if that quadratic divergence has a positive coefficient, the gravitino mass is forced to zero, and supersymmetry is unbroken, which means also the volume is forced to infinity. If it has a negative coefficient, then this is forced to the Planck scale, and so is the volume. So it really needs, on top of the magic one has already, some kind of quantum magic to produce a potential that would be, in any sense, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, there's a small literature in the context of large compact dimensions of stabilizing moduli, stabilizing the volume, and even without the constraints of string theory, even with the ability to turn on things like a bulk cosmological constant, they're often driven to include a Casimir energy. The reason I didn't want to is because I wanted things to be under control to some extent, and I worried that if I was in a situation where the one-loop vacuum energy was important, everything would be important. But also instantons, this is just classical. And at the end of the day, the stabilization of the vacuum might depend on quantum effects as well. Yeah, it's hard because, in the models that we've looked at, the classical potential is just going zoop towards large radius, and so, you could do it. It could pull it down in the middle. It's hard to imagine a case in which you could do that in a controllable way, but yeah.
Yeah.